Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. It's the show that aims to get you thinking, brings you conversations that matter every Saturday evening here on Premier Christian Radio and all over the world via our website and our podcast and indeed our YouTube channel. You can find links to all of that at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. You can also find things like blogs over at our Pathos blog too. We've got some great recent conversion stories that we've featured on the Unbelievable Pathos blog. Ailey, who we heard from at the end of last year, and also the story of Frank Frederico, who became a Christian after a science teacher challenged him to rethink his atheism. And that has been given to us by Jana Harmon, who's got a great new podcast called the Side B Podcast, telling people's conversion stories. And we're looking forward to featuring more of those stories from Jana on the blog in future. Links to the Pathos blog as well from today's show. But you can also find links to all the other good stuff that we've got from the show, our newsletter, ways to support the show, ways to get in contact and all the rest of it. Looking ahead as well, later on in the show, to some other exciting podcasts coming your way. A C.S. Lewis podcast is on the horizon. Plus, we'll get some of your feedback. And yes, well, we've had some mixed feedback, to put it mildly, on last week's show. I'll catch you up with that towards the end of today's programme. Looking forward to introducing my guest for a discussion on whether pro-lifer views and other unpopular opinions are being censored, cancelled on university campuses. So I'll be introducing my guests in just a moment's time. Before we get to them, just a reminder that Unbelievable, the conference, is coming on Saturday, the 15th of May, and you can attend from wherever you are in the world because it's all online this year. How to Tell the Greatest Story Ever Told is our theme. We're going to have keynote speakers including N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, Claire Williams, Sean and Josh McDowell, Ruth Jackson and myself hosting the conference. Not just another Zoom conference though, very much an interactive one. 3D Resource Hub will be part of it and a live edition of the Ask N.T. Wright Anything show. Lots of opportunity to get involved. We've even got a pay what you want option this year, so finance shouldn't be stand in the way of anyone being able to attend if they'd like to. Do check it all out at unbelievable.live. for the ticketing options, unbelievable.live to find out more. Right now, it's time to get into today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today on the show, we're asking, is free speech under threat on campus? Julia Rinkovich, Alison Scott Bowman and Ryan Christopher join me today. Now, the UK government recently announced the appointment of a free speech champion for universities over growing concerns over a so-called cancel culture on campus. Now, we're going to be talking about this today with my three guests. Julia is going to be talking about her experience as a student at Nottingham University, being suspended from her midwifery course for her involvement in the pro-life movement. Ryan Christopher is director of ADF UK, and their legal team won Julia's case, and he'll be explaining his concerns around the curtailing of free speech on campus. And Alison Scott Bowman is Professor of Society and Belief at SOAS University of London. She actually recently wrote a piece for The Guardian critiquing claims of a campus cancel culture and this recent report outlining plans for a free speech champion. So we'll be hearing her response to all this and asking questions like, can students be honest about their views on campus? Are traditional Christian views on sexuality, life and culture no longer allowed in a university setting. Are universities a place anymore for free inquiry and debate on ideas we may disagree with? Or is this all an overreaction? We're going to be just digging into these issues on today's show. So, Julia, tell us briefly about this experience you had doing your midwifery degree and what happened. Just take us through that story.
So I was suspended from my midwifery course as a result of my involvement in the pro-life society at the University of Nottingham. I was the president and heavily involved in getting the society set up. After it was set up, I received a letter from my university suspending me and making me go through a fitness to practice investigation.
So you'd set up this pro-life society, and were you sort of wanting it to be an official sort of, you know, campus organisation, as it were, to be affiliated with the university? Was that an issue in the first place?
Yeah. We tried to set up the society with and affiliate it with the University of Nottingham Students Union, and came into a few different issues with that. One of the issues was that we went against their equal opportunities policy, which still makes me laugh. That was quite a difficult time. And that's where I first got involved with ADF, and they helped us to affiliate.
But the suspension itself, being suspended from your midwifery course, what was that sort of just announced to you because you were heading up this society? What was the process? Did they sort of approach you and say, you can't do this, you have this position and be a midwife or training to be a midwife?
So the initial thing that I received didn't specify, if I'm honest. It just said due to professional concerns, I was being suspended. And it was only upon digging that they clarified that it was like as a direct result of my involvement in expressing my views. It was that I was expressing my views inappropriately.
So tell us about sort of how far into your course were you at this point, and what did that mean for, you know, how long did you have to put it on pause at that point?
So I was at the start of my final year of university when I received the letter. It only suspended me from placements, and at the time I was on a theory block, so I was still having to go into lectures, which were deeply uncomfortable, because I was being lectured by people who I knew had complained about me, and I was sat in a group of people where I knew a few of them had complained to my lecturers about me, so I was a bit isolated at that time.
And the nature of the complaints, was it because they felt that by representing this organisation, there was a conflict of interest with what the services you should be delivering as a midwife? Were they objecting to any particular things? I mean, were you involved in demonstrations and that kind of thing on campus that they felt were, you know, out of order?
Well, the reason they said was that I was handing out information, medical information, without the support of a midwife. When as a student midwife, we have to have a midwife there, which all I was doing in reality was standing at the freshers' fair stall, with leaflets available about the subject.
Well, we're looking forward to talking to Alison as well about her response to this, though Alison isn't here to specifically, obviously, debate the issue of abortion per se, and that's not what we're really debating today. It's more the general issues of free speech. But thank you for joining us, Julia. Before we go to Alison, Ryan, thank you for joining us from ADF. So you obviously got wind of Julia's case. What was the process, and how did, you know, this decision by the University of Nottingham get overturned in the end?
Yeah, in one sense, it was overturned in that they accepted they'd done some things wrong and issued a limited apology and a settlement for Julia. But they never really accepted that they'd done the most egregious thing, I think, which was to have a process that from the beginning left Julia feeling like she couldn't fully express her sincerely held worldview, which is a reasonable worldview a commonly held worldview and one that isn't incompatible with the practice of a professional duties in any way. And the process in the beginning was, I think, from what Julia said to me in the past, extraordinarily confusing and stressful and intimidating, because she was for weeks at the beginning unaware, as I understand it, of exactly what it was that was the issue. What the issue was tended to unfold with different language and different reasoning depending on the meeting. So as Julia said, she was initially very blind to the reasons by which she'd been suspended from all of her clinical practice. Now, in what that could have meant for Julia and what it looked certain to mean at the time was that she wouldn't be able to graduate that year. And what it resulted in as well was months of stress and uncertainty. So there was a lack of clarity in the process, and there was a reasonable sense, I think, for Julia that her pro-life views were at the heart of this, not any professional misconduct per se. To be suspended from your clinical practice, it usually takes something really egregious, like, you know, throwing babies around or, you know, something like that. So I think Julia was just completely gobsmacked by the reasoning given in the initial meeting. What is also extraordinary is part of the I guess, complaint against Julia was that she was in some way high profile as a pro-lifer, that she'd been in the media for being a pro-life young woman. And the irony of that is she'd been in the newspapers because she was the head of a pro-life society that had been unjustly prevented from affiliating by the university, who had to rescind that approach. So Julie was in a no-win situation there as a pro-life young woman. And at the end of the process, having accepted that there were all sorts of problems with the way that the university had handled the fitness to practice investigation for Julia, the university in effect still refused to accept that at the heart of this, lecturers that disagreed with Julia's worldview didn't want that worldview as an open worldview for those that practiced in her profession. And that's at the heart of the matter here. And in response to the newspaper articles that that reported on the apology to Julia, the university then said, basically, we're proudly pro-choice at the end of it. So I fear that the University of Nottingham, despite the apology, despite a settlement, hasn't really felt that anything really was done that was especially wrong.
Right. And what about the wider issue? Do you think this is symptomatic of something wider? I know that you commissioned a poll quite recently on whether students feel able to speak up on campus. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you some of the key aspects of that poll first, Justin. It was a national poll done by Survation nationwide. 44% of students fear that lecturers will treat them differently if they express their true opinions. 40% of students stated that views held by speakers and pressure from other student groups led more frequently to cancellation of events. More than one third of students feel their careers would be adversely affected. And 50% of the men that replied felt their careers would be adversely affected if they expressed their views on issues like abortion or biological sex, for example. That's really problematic for university culture, I think, to have statistics like that. And Julia's experience is a more extreme example of a university handling student opinions like hers. But I'm afraid it's the logical consequence of a mentality that we're seeing all over the country. We've seen, I guess, in the last 18 months that we've been involved with or known of, there have been at least 8 or 9 pro-life societies that have been either refused affiliation, where there's had to be a formal legal complaint made, or it to be heard in court in order to have that society have equal treatment. And we've had an awful lot of, I guess, less formal pressure, particularly by student unions who want to restrict the ability for pro-life societies to book rooms, speak openly, advertise on the internet, express their view about their philosophical or religious beliefs on the matter as well. So it's a big issue, no doubt.
Sure. Well, thank you for joining us, Ryan. If you want to find out more, by the way, about ADF's campaign on this front, it's protectfreespeech.uk. where you want to go. Alison, thank you for joining us as well on the show today. Before we sort of hear a response from you to this, I appreciate you kind of outlining what you understood this government sort of plans to be, a report outlining plans for a so-called free speech champion for universities that you were responding to in your recent Guardian article. Do you want to tell us what the government has proposed recently, where their concerns appear to be coming from?
Yes, thank you for inviting me on the show, Justin, Julia, Ryan. It's good to be here. So I'm here before you today as a mum and a granny, and obviously a daughter and a wife. So I have great interest in this matter. But as you said so rightly, this is not my area of expertise professionally, midwifery. So I've been analysing the government's approach. And we could ask ourselves three questions. How much of the government's desired approach on this free speech is new or is necessary? The point is that universities already have a strong duty to uphold and support free speech. Now, we can talk definitely later. I'll be very interested to have a proper conversation later about the situation that that Julia found herself in. But the fact is that, as I quoted in my Guardian article, the Office for Students added up all the free speech events that took place on campus in 2018. How many were there? 160,000, and 53 of them were banned. So there are, you know, masses of events take place, a lot of which are controversial. Only 53 in a whole year were banned. So of over 60,000 events, 53 were banned. I can't stress that too much. So is this necessary? I personally think not. Secondly, will the proposals achieve what the ministers want them to achieve? They say they would like to advocate and protect free speech at all costs. But this is already there. Academic staff and students already have freedom within the law to question, to test the limits of ideas, and to put forward new ideas. They shouldn't receive risk as a result of that. So what this does tell us, my third question really about this, is what does this tell us about the ongoing relationship between the government and the university sector? And I think this is one that is based on suspicion by the government. And it's possible that the government is buying into what I think is a myth-making device. There's a lot of media exaggeration about what happens. If one case blows up, then it's seen as typical of the whole sector. And this is clearly, if you accept my figures, which the Office for Students presented themselves, then this is clearly not the case.
So overall, you feel that there is an exaggeration going on here. And although there may be some instances where it's questionable and we need to look at those, there isn't overall a problem of free speech on campus. I mean, would it be fair to say that the tone has changed towards the kind of views that, for instance, Julia represents in terms of, you know, a pro-life position, that people who hold that are going to be increasingly questioned? Is it any harder, in a sense, to be a pro-life student on campus, to have an organisation representing that, to hold events, even to hold discussions, debates on the issue? Because you do appear to see stories, but in the media, that suggest that you know that there is a problem here, or do you think they're actually being blown out of proportion?
I think they're being blown out of proportion, but of course there is an issue in that Julia should be free to express her views. What Julia can't expect is that people should necessarily agree with them or, you know, accept them in a pleasant way. So, you know, we are all free to hold our own views, but we can't force others to fit in with them. We can't expect that. I think if I could just raise a really interesting issue at this point, which is that when I did a big over 2,000 students, a survey across the whole of the UK, they were attending 130 universities, and we were asking them about free speech issues. And a contradiction emerges. Over 80% of them, and this is across all ethnic minorities as well, believe that universities should allow free speech. Great. OK, thank you very much. Seems straightforward. But the same cohort of over 2,000 students attending 130 universities. 75% of them, so it's a very similar figure, believe that minorities should be protected so that they're not discriminated against. So this is the crux of the matter, really, because in this story, in this narrative, Julia represents a minority. The majority of students believe that minorities should not be discriminated against, but they also, as a majority, advocate free speech. So this creates a massive contradiction. Now, it has been argued by some that this means that students are confused. They don't know what they want. I don't agree with that. I think it means that students understand that there's a complex issue at stake, but they don't know how to resolve it. So, you know, later on this morning, maybe we could discuss certain ways in which these issues could be resolved. But there is a contradiction there at the heart of the matter. So I'm not, please don't think I'm saying there's not a problem. There definitely is an issue to be resolved, but I don't think it's on this massive scale.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to hear your response to that, Ryan, both the idea that there is a contradiction to some extent at what where students feel drawn. They want free speech, but they also sort of are wary of, you know, voices that go against the grain in that sense. But but also generally the statistics that Alison's brought to bear there, suggesting actually, are we making more of this than there is, you know, 60,000 free speech events, only 50 or so of which got cancelled. Is it really the problem you're claiming?
Yeah, I think the Office for Student Stats, I'll take them as they are. I'd be surprised if they capture the reality, the day-to-day for most student societies, and that every request for a room booking or a meeting is somehow recorded there. But even if it's a low percentage number, it's well understood in all sorts of areas of life, whether it be medicine or law or philosophy, that for something to be a substantial problem doesn't mean it has to be a problem for the majority, right? So students recognise that minorities should be protected and respected. And what we're finding, I think, is that there is a really substantial problem for certain minority views or less popular views or views that aren't with the winds of the zeitgeist. So the Alliance of Pro-Life Students, for example, commissioned their own internal poll. Fine, it's not a national poll, it's not a professional company. But they asked 200 of their members about their experiences as pro-lifers, again, one of these minority views that tend to struggle more. And they found that 65% of them said that students have witnessed another pro-lifer being discriminated against or harassed for holding those views. 70% have faced situations in lectures or seminars where they've been felt that they cannot speak about their views. And a quarter themselves have said they've been threatened, abused, alarmed, or distressed by this. I know myself, I know of five post-grad students at universities over the last number of years who have been told by supervisors or other members of staff or other fellow students that their grades will suffer if they take the pro-life line. And on similar issues, I've had friends who have been told they have to use, particular pronoun usage in research that has nothing to do with the gender debate, or their marks will be lower. So I think whether there's a big problem isn't necessarily about the percentage of students or the percentage of events. It's whether certain views are being actively suppressed. And I think around half the time that pro-life societies try to do something, as one example, they're facing really formal and big informal and informal challenges. So that's the nature of the problem, I think. I wouldn't disagree that it's not the majority of events.
Yeah.
On the proposed contradiction between students being for free speech and also wanting minority views to be heard, I think there's only a contradiction if you buy into identity politics, an inherent kind of division between people. And I think what the government's trying to do, and I'm not here to defend the government, but I think what the government's trying to do is to say, listen, in a democratic and small L liberal society, post-war human rights era, we should be able to hold minority views at the same time as respecting free speech. That those things should just naturally go together, right? That there's that ongoing tolerance, particularly on a university campus, where the nature of the endeavour is to share ideas that are controversial.
Just before we go to a break, I just wanted to bring you back in, Julia, and say, Firstly, do you welcome sort of these government proposals for a free speech champion? And do you think it can change what presumably is for you an atmosphere not just of can I book a room, but do you kind of conceive, do you sort of resonate with this poll that ADF did, that students don't feel able to speak up generally because of a given atmosphere around a particular issue on campus?
I very much agree with the poll. I welcome the proposed changes, but obviously there's a question of how much change is it going to do, and when's the change going to happen, and is it going to protect all like minority views, because obviously they're going to have to draw a line
somewhere.
What views they protect, and it adds up so much complication, I suppose.
And I think that's what we want to tease out maybe in the next section of the show is sort of where do we draw these lines? Because I think very often, different people will have a different level at which they think, well, this view is offensive or potentially dangerous to people on campus if it's given, if it's allowed to be expressed. And there may be things where we could all agree, some sort of heinous racist view shouldn't be allowed to just be given free expression on campus. But for those who see a pro-life view as potentially dangerous for women's rights, for women's safety, and so on, and presumably those were the kinds of arguments you were meeting, Julia, that your view was actually dangerous simply for being expressed in that way on campus.
It felt like they were treating us like we were going to be causing harm to women, and we'd be standing outside abortion clinics, like pushing women and telling them how awful they are. That's what it felt like we were being treated like. Obviously, I think I think that they were in the wrong thinking that, because I think that the pro-life view is quite peaceful. And
so there was a concern that your methods and so on would be dangerous and unpleasant on campus and so on. Well, I'll get Alison to respond to that, not specifically necessarily to, as I say, Alison's not here to debate the issue of pro-life versus pro-choice, but where that line should exist in terms of what sort of views are allowed to be expressed on campus versus those that legitimately, do have a sort of a danger for students if they're allowed on campus. So we'll be back for the second part of today's show in just a moment's time. It's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. We're debating, is free speech under threat on campus? My guests are Julia Rinkovich, Alison Scott Bowman and Ryan Christopher joining me today on the show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the show. Here on Unbelievable today, we're asking, is free speech under threat on campus? Looking particularly at the case of Julia Rinkovich, who was dismissed from, or at least suspended from, her midwifery course at Nottingham University because of her championing of pro-life issues. Ryan Christopher, director of ADF UK, is here to talk about the fact that they supported Julia going against that, and they actually won Julia's case. And they do believe there is a problem of cancel culture on UK campuses. Alison Scott Bowman, Professor of Society and Belief at SOAS University, wrote a piece for The Guardian critiquing government plans to appoint a free speech champion. Says a lot of these issues are overblown, exaggerated. I suppose, Alison, I wanted to come back to you because I think it is really difficult sometimes, because people hold different sort of levels, if you like, of what constitutes an offensive or dangerous belief. Obviously, for Julia, her pro-life views, it's perfectly legitimate for her to hold them, to express them, to talk about them with other people. I can imagine others feeling like, no, that view is actually personally dangerous for me because I believe so strongly in reproductive rights or whatever terminology they might use, that this could be dangerous for women who are facing that kind of a choice on campus, and so on. And they believe actually this isn't just a free speech issue. This is an issue of hate speech or, some sort of dangerous form of speech, at least. So how do we sort of navigate where the line should be drawn? Who gets to draw that line ultimately in these sort of university campus settings.
Yeah, well, you're right. It's complicated. I mean, the university has the right to actively support free speech. And so that's that. They're in the firing line at the moment because they're, you know, the woke brigade, all these elements about identity politics make the whole scene very complicated. I do wonder, however, whether what we're talking about this morning really is a free speech issue, because the Office of the Independent Adjudicator on Higher Education has commented that student complaints that involve freedom of speech are actually often to do with academic research or fitness to practice or disciplinary matters, and they may involve professional standards. So I don't know Julia's case, but given that it's around midwifery training and pro-life issues, which are in contradiction to each other, then it's possible this is not a free speech issue at the heart. It's actually to do with academic research or professional standards, for example. But I do think that there is an issue on campus which we should all address full on, which is that Julia is entitled to have her opinions, and the student union on a university campus should allow and support the establishment of pro-life activities. The issue then becomes complicated at a personal level for Julia and others who have the same views, because using the label pro-life, for me, that's not exactly clear what that actually means. Does that mean no termination is ever acceptable? Does it mean some might be? This could go directly against women's rights as they are understood in this country. And so Julia therefore has to expect professional conflict and really deep soul searching and torment, because this is a minority view that should be discussed, but it should be done carefully. And I'm very happy to talk about the carefulness that one could bring to bear on these difficult situations.
Well, let's return to that in a moment, if that's okay, yeah. Alison. I mean, Ryan, perhaps you'd like to comment on some of what Alison had to say there, particularly, I mean, was there specifically an issue with the fact that Julia was doing a midwifery course? And so it's going to be different when she's doing that kind of a course and in certain placement situations, holding the view she does. I can imagine some people saying she has to be open to the idea that some people may not want to continue their pregnancy. And therefore, it's a bit different than someone simply studying a humanities degree or whatever and is heading up a pro-life, because there's a conflict between her professional, you know, capacity of what she's willing to do and so on. So that's an interesting point that Alison makes there. What do you make of that, Ryan?
Yeah, I think there's a real problem in saying on the one hand that someone is really genuinely free to say what they believe and to live according to those sincerely held beliefs. And let's be honest, when we're acting according to deeply held convictions, not speaking about them is not a full living in that sense. To say that Julia's free on that hand, but she shouldn't be free, which is what the midwifery school in effect was saying, to express her views as a member of a society or to be online and say that I'm pro-life. That isn't a true freedom. That's a pretense at actual freedom. And the fact of the matter is that holding a pro-life view in and of itself does not violate any of the codes of practice for being a midwife in any way whatsoever. And Julia's reviews on her practical placements were of excellence. This is one of the things that came up in the process of conversation with the university is, has anyone ever expressed any concern with that actual practice as a midwife or how she's dealt with any woman? Has she been judgmental or aggressive with any person in practice? And the answer is no. And unless we're willing to live in a society and have a professional kind of environment where people are free to hold convictions and express them, because that's what that really means, and to treat people with tolerance and compassion, then our democratic liberal society and universities and midwifery as a profession are all in trouble, I think. It's a very dangerous road to start going down. We saw a similar case with the Felix Ngole scenario. He was training to be a social worker, and he put on Facebook, in a way that Julia didn't, it was more provocative, one could say, that certain acts are sinful, even an abomination. And he was removed from his social services course. The Court of Appeal overturned that because it said the logic of the behaviour of the University of Sheffield in saying that you cannot speak of this at all in any way in public, hold those moral convictions and be a social worker would mean a blanket ban in effect for Christians that hold traditional views. So I think it's a really dangerous road to start going down to say it would somehow impugn Julia's professional conduct in any way.
I'd be interested in your response to that, Alison, and we'll obviously get Julia's perspective on this as well.
Yes, I mean, I know we're not here to discuss that particular aspect. I think as a practicing midwife, this will create dilemmas, which will be complicated. But I think the more important issue here that we're discussing today is how do we earn the right to get people to listen to our opinions? Because free speech is not really a right. It's not an absolute value. It's something that has to be negotiated. And this is something that the university authorities, they can't hold our hand on this. We have to manage this ourselves in seminar rooms, in the student union, in lecture halls, in the coffee room. So the issue about how to negotiate with others, whether they will listen to you, using persuasion, using charm, using figures, using facts, using belief systems. This is the way in which we have to negotiate our way forward. And there is no absolute right to Julia or anybody else to be heard or even to be heard respectfully. It would be great if that was possible, but the entitlement is there to try. But there is no obligation on anybody to actually stop contradicting or you know, avoid denying the reality of what somebody else believes.
Yeah, I think we all agree. All of us on this call agree that the best response, ultimately, to speech we disagree with or a worldview we find abhorrent, is more speech, right? Better speech, and in practice, in culture on campus, I can't go around expecting people to listen to my view or agree with it or even respect it, right? To really give me the light of day. I can't expect people to not insult me even for my views. I think that's between individuals in lots of ways. But I think to say that there isn't an absolute right to speech and we have to negotiate that space in practice with each other, which are both true, is to somewhat sidestep the real issue that people like Julia have faced, which in practice is this. It's that minority groups on campus or a minority of the student body or academics vehemently dislike other minority views. And they will then use all the formal means available to them to try and suppress those societies, deny their existence, and try and remove their speech from that space in practice. So we can talk about negotiation in practice, but I'm afraid what students like Julia and others face is not a hostile debating environment. It's an environment that looks to use the formal means of university processes and professional investigation in order to actually get rid of them. And in the case of academics, get them sacked. There's so many cases of that where they've been investigated. Or in the case of Noah Carl, by the time you can take it to court, the damage is done to your reputation. The minority of students and academics on campus that are using these formal means know that what this does is it creates a chilling effect for certain minority views, like pro-life or pro-Palestine or pro-Israel or whatever it might be. And they're happy to use them to that effect. And that's about power dynamics and using actual levers in ways that are inappropriate, not just about the rough and tumble of debate.
Julia, did I hear right that Nottingham subsequently issued a statement that the student union is formally pro-choice? And I think I heard that, I think it was a Cardiff as well, someone did that because they were concerned about a pro-life organisation being allowed on the student union and so on. And this was a sort of response to say. Now, for you, is that sort of... in a way, making it difficult to hold your view? Or do you just accept, well, that's fine, that's the prerogative of the student union if they all vote that they overall hold a pro-choice stance? You're willing to accept that there's going to be a hostile atmosphere, but that's, you know, but you're willing to accept that in that sense. Where is it okay, you know, for people to essentially disagree strongly with you on campus in that way?
I think it's okay for people to disagree with us strongly, but for the organisation as a whole to take on a political belief like that feels quite threatening. And it feels like they've done it because they find us threatening.
Do you feel then that you're being at some level discriminated against by the student union taking that particular stance? You know, do you feel like it's one thing to say we welcome dialogue and debate on this, but when the student union says we take a view on this, you actually feel like your existence of your society and your beliefs are ultimately being totally called into question by the institution more than just sort of the fact that different students have different perspectives on campus?
Yeah. It feels a bit cheeky for them to go ahead and say, well, we welcome the pro-life society coming into the campus, but we actively disagree with them and we don't associate with them at all. It sort of almost defeats the point of us becoming associated with them in a way. But obviously, individuals in the students' union have the right to have those strong beliefs and they have the right to protest against our events. But for it to be the institution as a whole is a bit almost unnecessary, I think.
And Justin, this really is the heart of the problem that the government proposals are trying to fix, which one of the big problems, and there are four or five, but one of them is that student unions are not subject to the same direct duties that the university itself is to reasonably ensure that free speech happens. And so whilst they don't have that direct duty, they feel like they have the liberty to take these kind of stances against certain minority views or less popular views. In the case of pro-lifers, it's that the student unions, and there are several of them in the country, that have said, passed formal motions that we are a pro-choice student union, which in all sorts of ways is problematic in other legal senses. And so student unions, I think in practice, cause 90% of the problems because, quite frankly, a lot of the students aren't aware of the legal duties that the universities already have to practically ensure free speech. And they themselves feel that they're immune from taking these stances.
I'm going to be interested in Alison's response to that. But I can imagine, you know, in the 1980s, you know, plenty of student unions taking a anti-apartheid stand. You know, that was agreed on. That was the ethical position of the students as a body. Why is it different for the pro-choice issue? If they equally feel this is an ethical issue and we're allowed to kind of speak as a unified voice if the majority of our members vote, you know, in accordance with that?
Because, to put it short, in almost every single case where you see a motion of principle like that passed, you see practical consequences that are laid out in what that means for student life. And in one case, it's even meant that there's an encouragement for other students to protest pro-life events. And again, you can say that's snowflakey to have an issue with that, but to have the student union that is meant to equally respect and represent all students passing formal motions that in practice practically discriminate against certain groups and say certain other groups are illegitimate is really problematic, not least because in many cases student unions are providers of public services and they have duties under the law to be fostering good relations between groups rather than stoking that kind of division. So I don't think apartheid and pro-lifers on campus is necessarily a great kind of parallel.
Yeah, I think the student unions they're facing difficult problems all the time, very difficult decisions they have to make. They do have the authority of the Charity Commission, which looks after them. The Charity Commission, because a student union is a charity, they are managed by the Charity Commission. I think this could certainly be strengthened in the sense that the student unions do need to be prepared to accept what the obligations are upon them. And as I said right at the beginning, it is not reasonable to deny the existence of a pro-life society. That is legally permissible. However, I do come back to the point I was making earlier on about negotiation. I stick with this very strongly, that we can't just shout at each other. There's no point saying, I believe this, and therefore it's right. There have to be negotiated positions adopted, and student unions could be the best place for doing this. I think the problem they're up against, though, is that a lot of what's being said here today is this mythology that's developed, which is that free speech is under threat on campus. And this is absolutely not true. It is a mythology spread by the press, by the government, and by certain minority groups. So this is very confusing, because it means that students who fill in your ADF poll have bought into that. They think, oh, this, yeah, there are huge risks. Yes, I am not able to speak freely. This has always been true, but now they see it as a political position. It's always been true that we have to think before we speak. I've been married for 40 years. My husband and I think before we speak to each other quite a lot of the time, because this is about human relationships. Human relationships are reliant upon mutual respect and mutual recognition. So it's not, I don't think it's reasonable or fair or accurate to vilify the university sector on as a whole sector and say that this is a massive problem which is out of control. It's completely untrue. And this very mythology actually makes it harder to develop the kind of negotiation and mutual recognition that I'm striving for.
Well, I'd be interested in your response to that, Ryan. Do you think this is a mythology? Is this a sort of, you know, just a reactionary sort of campaign cooked up by, you know, conservative wing and tabloids that enjoy stoking this kind of stuff?
I obviously don't think it's a mythology. And like on lots of issues in our culture, we recognise that those who feel that their view is illegitimate or won't be supported by authorities or by the majority or by due process, they're less likely to report the issues that they're having. So I think an awful lot of the problems that students face on campus are actually not reported and don't get to the media and aren't spoken about. And those that we do see in the media are representative of the real issue where it does exist on campus. I don't deny that the majority of events can go ahead. That's absolutely the case. But again, I'll say on particular views, like, for example, the objective reality of a biological male and female, we've seen several very concrete things happen to high-profile academics in the last year or year and a half. Jordan Peterson was disinvited from his visiting lectureship at Cambridge University because he held a certain view on pronouns, in effect. It's extraordinary. Mike McCulloch, I believe a professor of physics, if I'm not mistaken, was investigated by his university formally for liking tweets that said all lives matter, and again for stating his view that biological male and female is an objective reality. And of course, Mike McCulloch wasn't sacked in the end, right? But Noah Kahle was, and Jordan Peterson wasn't able to take up a lectureship that he was, again, on merit, should have taken. And even when you are reinstated, there's a massive chilling effect, right? If you're an academic and you see this, you're like, I'm not going to stick my head above the parapet. I'm going to start self-censoring. And self-censoring is the cultural result of these processes, of these formal levers being used to suppress particular views in particular. And lastly, I'll just make a comment on that it's a political position to say that there's a free speech crisis. I think it's an apolitical or pre-political necessity for a democracy and for a university that free speech is universally protected. And in that sense, I welcome the government's intervention.
And this appears to be the problem, Alison, that a lot of people are saying is university should be a place where you can have the free exchange of ideas and people are willing to hear ideas that they fundamentally disagree or even are offended by. But that's the point. We have to learn how to debate and there is this quote unquote snowflake culture that some people think is developing where students have to be protected. They have to have their safe spaces. They have to, you know, never be presented with a view that might potentially offend them. Now, whether or not it's happening in a legal, you know, in a strict sense that events are being shut down or cancelled, I think what Ryan says is there's a chilling effect on free speech because, you know, university is not doing what it should do anymore. Now, you're on a in a university context yourself. Do you just say that's just not the reality, that actually people can debate and discuss ideas openly? There's no sort of ideas that, you know, cannot be mentioned or are kind of somehow, you know, should,
no,
you know,
yeah,
don't get a public airing in that kind of way.
There are, of course, there are issues that, and increasingly because the university campus represents a huge diversity of cultural beliefs and backgrounds, of course there are issues that need to be debated. But I just asked myself what could possibly go wrong in this situation. This is a government who is advancing the idea that free speech must be protected. But this is a government that is responsible for suppressing free speech in minorities of colour. So issues like the securitisation, the anti-terror programme Prevent, that means that epistemic injustice is meted out big time to Muslims or people who look as if they might be Muslim or people with brown skin. So there is a lot of self-censorship on the part of large minorities. I mean, you've got 8 or 9% of the British university population are Muslims. Most of them, I think, as we could say on in this context, probably would be pro-life, actually. But in terms of my research, this epistemic injustice is what I mean by that is that these people are not considered to have opinions worth listening to. And so this is a government who has rolled that out across the whole university sector, all across all public sectors. They've also instructed the Charity Commission to be oppressive on campuses where there are minority groups who might want to discuss Israel-Palestine, for example. So what could possibly go wrong? This is a government which is saying that it wants to advocate free speech at all costs, but this is a government which itself has created self-censorship trigger points themselves, and they've done it very systematically, and it's very effective. So I think my point on this argument would be that we're not going to get more free speech as a result of this. If the free speech champion is brought in, it's not going to create more free speech opportunities, because that's not the way this government works.
We'll go to a quick break, and we're going to just continue discussing and finish discussing this issue of free speech on campus. My guests on Unbelievable today are Julia Rinkovic, Alison Scott-Bauman and Ryan Christopher. Hello and welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Thanks for being with us. We're returning to our discussion on campus cancel culture in just a moment's time. If you can come back at the same time next week, well, we're still working actually on what we're going to be bringing you next time, but just a couple of things I do want to let you know about. In 2 weeks' time, we're releasing a new C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath. He is simply one of the world's, if not the world's, leading expert on C.S. Lewis. So look out for more details about that. If you love podcasts and you like C.S. Lewis and Alistair McGrath, it's just going to be the perfect combo. And then soon after that, on Easter weekend, we'll be launching Big Conversation Season 3. Really excited to say that our first episode will see well-known YouTube atheist Alex O'Connor, a.k.a. Cosmic Skeptic, in conversation with the influential Christian thinker Bishop Robert Barron from Word on Fire, well-known for his own YouTube channel. So look out for that. A bit more about that later on in the show as well. Don't forget, of course, that if you can join us for Unbelievable the Conference on Saturday the 15th of May, you will be in for a real treat. N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, Claire Williams, Sean and Josh McDowell, all being featured at this year's conference. Tom Wright and Tom Holland will be having a conversation as part of that. We'll have a live question and answer session with Tom as well. So it's going to be a great day. And as well as covering all of the important things we need to cover in an apologetics and evangelism conference on how to tell the greatest story ever told, how we tell that story to a new generation that's largely forgotten it, and the story that has really shaped us in the West. We'll also be covering some of those issues that we need to cover around, you know, how we respond to some of the recent things like this Ravi Zacharias scandal and so on. Sean and Josh McDowell, I'm sure, will be able to speak into that. Josh has just a lifetime's experience as a veteran of Christian apologetics, really helped to establish modern apologetics in the church in many ways. So there's going to be a lot of good stuff, a lot of good stuff for reflection, but also to inspire you and help you to understand and equip you in actually conveying your faith to others. Unbelievable.live if you'd like to to book your place from anywhere in the world this year because it's all online. Unbelievable.live for Saturday the 15th of May. And we're holding it in a time frame that should be friendly, we hope, to our friends in the USA. So look out for that again. Unbelievable.live. Just want to say a hello to Anna, who got in touch to say she wants to say thanks for all the great interviews and podcasts. I'm a new Christian and find your podcasts reassuring, and they really help me get my head around the complicated things that sometimes put me off joining a church before. I've really enjoyed the episode with Richmond Wandera, and I have sponsored a child in Uganda through Compassion, but I don't think I did it through your link, so don't know if it was counted in the number that you're trying to reach. Well, Anna, if you didn't sponsor it specifically via compassion.org/Justin, then no, it won't have counted towards our show total, but that really doesn't matter. The main thing is that you're sponsoring a child, and that's really excellent. I think those who have sponsored specifically through the show link, I think we're at well over 80 sponsorships now, which is wonderful. We're hoping to bring it up to around 100. So if you've been thinking about doing it, but you haven't got around to it, and you enjoyed that conversation with Richmond Wandera, he's a living example of the difference the child sponsorship can make. So again, do feel free to sponsor, again, using, if possible, the show link, compassion.org/Justin. And if you're sponsoring from the USA to do that, then you get a free copy of my Unbelievable book as well. We're going to go to the final part of today's discussion, and we'll have time for your feedback towards the end as well. Yes, there's a lot of feedback. We need to have a talk about what happened on last week's show. But for now, let's conclude today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's discussion. We've been asking, is free speech under threat on campus? My guests have been Julia Rinkovich, Ryan Christopher and Alison Scott Bowman. If you want more about ADF's campaign, protectfreespeech.uk is the place to go. If you want more about Alison Scott Bowman, check out her profile on the SOAS website as well. I'll make sure there are links to all of my guests from today's show as well. You can find that if you're watching via video in the info. You can equally get hold of all of the stuff you need from the Premier Christian Radio website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Juliet, let's come to you first of all, just so we start to wrap up today's show. Are there any kind of specific examples you can give where you've felt there's been a kind of a difficulty putting your point of view across? Obviously, you've had the whole case and the dismissal, but when you're actually running sort of a pro-life event, is that a difficult thing to do on campus?
It has been a bit of a threat beforehand. There's always been like the threat of a protest at our events. One of the first events that we held, we actually had about 15-20 people attend who were protesting against us. So we had equal numbers of pro-life pro-choicers, and it was quite interesting because a few of them were very welcoming of having a debate and listening to our speaker. A few were quite determined to interrupt him and fight against him, but it was interesting having the dynamic of some of the pro-choicers almost telling the others to shut up and listen to the guy and give him a chance. So I was thinking about how it didn't feel too much of a problem on the ground. That event didn't feel like much of a problem. It feels much more like it's the overarching of the students' union that has been the main problem for us, because even if our events have been protested, they've been like it's almost been handled quite well and interestingly.
Right. So in a sense, you don't object to people turning up and disagreeing and even potentially disrupting your event. Though I suppose there's a sort of a point at which you have to say that we have to be able to hold an event if we're going to be an organisation on campus. But You're willing to accept the fact that people will vehemently disagree with you, and that's not necessarily a problem for you, Julia.
No, I think it. Sometimes, in some cases, it is a bit disruptive, but it does make for an interesting dynamic. And how else will they find out about different beliefs if they don't come protest and
yeah
maybe in, listen indeed. A little bit.
And I was going to ask as well, I mean, you're there, obviously, your activities have been disrupted and your own education has been disrupted as well. But what about the actual effect of what you're doing? Do you feel like, given that it has caused quite a stir on campus, that actually people have been willing to listen who maybe have never considered the pro-life perspective? Have you seen people actually come over to your side of the fence, as it were, in the process because of the campaigning you do in that sort of scenario?
I think I've noticed a bit of a softening of hearts of people. For example, the person who was the president of the Pro-Choice Society at the time, the same time as me, I actually received a really, really lovely message from her when I was suspended from the course, and she noticed my story in the newspaper and sent me quite a lovely supportive message. So I've not noticed anyone like turning to our side per se, but definitely a bit of a welcoming of our view, I think, on campus.
That's interesting to hear. Thank you for sharing. I mean, Ryan, just coming back to you on that last point Alison made in the last section of the programme, she feels, you know, it's not a good idea asking the government to police free speech on campus, because they're doing a terrible job, in her opinion, themselves on that front. She mentions the Prevent campaign, and she feels that, you know, Muslim students that she's interacted with have had to self-censor because of government policies themselves about free speech and so on. And so, what's your view on that? Is she just says that they're not the right people to be enforcing this stuff.
I think the problem then is who is the right person. And again, I'm not for more legislation and bureaucracy and positions for its own sake, absolutely not. But the reality is we have a situation in which these universities are publicly funded bodies providing a public service, and they sign up to the principles that the government's trying to hold them to account for. And I don't think the government would be looking to interfere at all in this, that's my view, if the problems weren't real on the ground. The law as it is actually quite good. You know, universities have a duty to ensure that free speech happens using all practicable means. And what we're seeing in reality is that universities, again, particularly when it comes to unpopular views, are not willing to do their duty, and particularly student unions, again, feeling like they're exempt from this. And so the real issue at heart, I think, that the government's interventions don't hit, directly at least, are that there needs to be an awful lot more training into those duties and the value of freedom of speech and mutual toleration. And there needs to be, I think, more robust guidance given to student union reps and to members of the university as well. And I think there's a bigger problem above that as well, that these government proposals can't fix, but other legislative amendments would, which is that whilst on the one hand, universities have a duty to ensure freedom of speech on campus, their codes of conduct are often informed by the language in the Public Order Act. And a lot of the Public Order Act offences are so vaguely worded that it gives universities the wiggle room to say, we will legitimately deplatform, no platform, or cancel speakers that might cause distress or alarm to other people. And I'm afraid that that's a line that is far, far too low to be drawing to enable freedom of speech either on campus or in society as a whole.
Alison, any final thoughts as we start to draw this together?
Yeah, no, this has been a really interesting discussion. And I think we have to just briefly consider the bigger picture, which is that we're living in a culture now where social media is so dominant, and social media with its manipulative algorithms, you know, it's encouraging us to define our relationships with others by the level of offence that they cause to us or that we cause to them. So this adversarial positionality is really, really shocking. And if you want an expert on this, there's my book, Freedom of Speech in Universities, in which I develop Ryan's point, which is that if we train staff and students, they can recover something which we may have had maybe 20 years ago, which was the capacity to talk more courteously, but also very sharply with each other. I don't mean being courteous just for the sake of being kind, but being able to avoid the standoffs that Julia described, but also facilitate the possibility of negotiated discussion, which Julia also describes. So we really, there is work to be done, but this is a huge societal issue. I don't think it should be laid on the shoulders of the universities. Across societies, particularly in, as I say, with the social media being so dominant, we've become argumentative, and we're not looking for similarities, we're looking for differences. We need to really work harder towards mutual recognition. And this means facilitating what universities know very well how to do, but are actually they're feeling a little bit nervous about it for all sorts of reasons that we've explored.
Indeed. And I'm so glad that this at least has been a forum in which we can have a really helpful mutual conversation about these issues without taking offence at each other. So I want to thank you all for being involved on the show today. Julia, just as we close out the programme, I guess now you do have the opportunity to complete your course, and that I'm sure is a very welcome thing, isn't it?
Yes, I'm very excited to finally graduate the university.
Fantastic. Look forward to hearing more about what the future holds for you on that front. And thanks for your input as well, Ryan, today. What's available at this website, protectfreespeech.uk? I assume you've got the results there of this poll you did. What is it also to help people who do feel that they're facing, you know, issues of free speech on campus and so on?
Yeah, we hope to develop resources that will be placed on there very soon. In fact, one of the resources we're currently working on is a guide to students and their rights to freedom of speech under the law as it stands on campus, which will update if the government proposals go through and change that legislation. It also includes some of the problems outlined very clearly in a letter to the Prime Minister, and it gives people the opportunity to add their name to that and encourage the government to see these proposals through, which we hope will be the case.
Well, thank you for joining us today as well. I'll make sure there are links to that and indeed to your book, Alison, as well, so people can look into that further as well. But for now, Julia, Ryan and Alison, thank you for being with me on today's show.
Thanks, Justin.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's show. Feel free to get in touch. The usual methods apply. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave your thoughts via our social media at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for our Facebook page. You can even check me out on Instagram too, justin.briley there, or indeed on TikTok, where I sometimes post little apologetic videos, 60-second sort of thoughts on apologetics. Anyway, we've had quite a bit of feedback in the last week or so, and that's because we had a show last week on Is Christianity a White Man's Religion, and mainly negative feedback, I've got to confess. Ruth Jackson was presenting that dialogue between AJ Varma of the Holy Coptic Church and Vince Bantu of Fuller Seminary. Now I'm going to hold my hands up here and say this was a bit of a misfire, actually, this show, but let's just hear what some of you had to say first. we're never afraid of our critics here on Unbelievable. So let's hear what some of you had to say. And you, by and large, you all said it extremely graciously as well. Lars says, first, let me say thank you for this show and the conversations you've hosted over the years. I'm a PhD student in the US, came to faith about 3.5 years ago, and your programme was a huge part of that journey. Thanks for all the amazing discussions you've hosted over the years. On to the recent episode, I'd love to see this conversation attempted again at some point. I think this was a really interesting premise with a lot of history to be discussed and evaluated, but frankly, I felt the speakers failed to have a proper dialogue. To me, it felt as if Dr. Varma and Dr. Bantu never responded to one another's points, even though their opinions differed greatly. Dr. Bantu did not challenge blatant falsities or claims counter to central Christian belief made by Dr. Varma, which just caught me as very odd. Anyway, not here to give an analysis. I was just excited for the conversation, but disappointed in how the speakers approached the discussion. I'd love to see a similar conversation tried again. Thank you, Lars. That was a very gracious way of expressing it. I'm also incredibly glad to hear that the show was helpful in your own journey towards Christianity. This one from Josh said, thanks for hosting this week, Ruth, long-time listener here in Columbus, Ohio. Some criticism ahead. Please take it on the chin. The episode was a mess, in my opinion, alternating between airings of grievances, some weird I know more ancient words than you games, and Dr. Bantu and Varma were all over the map, which, of course, has been manipulated for hundreds of years to distort the Hawaiian Islands being just a few inches off the coast of California. I think the main question was probably too general, and I'm not really sure that these two guests were a good fit for each other. Not that we all relish a big fight or something, but the contrast between guests is crucial. crucial to the depth of the conversation. Dr. Varma believes the biblical text has been manipulated. He seems to put other world religions on the same level as Christianity, and he seems to think Christianity was already thriving in indigenous populations all over the world before they even heard about Jesus. Maybe they didn't even need the Great Commission. Varma is the type of guest that's begging for a good sparring partner, and Bantu this time just didn't fit the bill, or maybe he did on paper, and it was just about steering the conversation. What we ended up with was all the things they agree on, all secure in the safety zone. Unbelievable has proven many times that there are experts at the top of their game that fundamentally disagree with one another. Listeners like me aren't just looking for a brawl. We're seeking the truth, which is nuanced and at sometimes elusive. So for me, the winning formula is twofold: experts with contrasting views on a given subject and appropriate moderation to draw out or fine-tune the lens of these contrasts. Thank you, Josh, for that position, for that perspective. Peter says, I imagine your inbox is pretty full after the latest podcast. I'll try to keep it brief. It seemed like one of your guests, Dr. Varma, was promoting some version of the Black Hebrews belief, which says that African Americans are the true Israelites. I imagine some of your Jewish listeners may have found this offensive, and I'm surprised he went unchallenged in the debate. Although I'm sure he's a peaceful guy, some Black Hebrews hold anti-Semitic views and have carried out hate crimes in America. I'll leave it there. Thanks for doing the show. I've been recommending it to lots of my friends at church since I discovered it a year or so. Thank you, Peter. And David says, just finished listening to the episode. I was disappointed. I was expecting a productive debate, but in reality, there was little disagreement between the two guests. The show, unfortunately, became a platform for unsubstantiated conspiracy theories about the origins and supposed illegitimacy of Christianity. At times, I felt like I was listening to a sequel to the discredited documentary Zeitgeist. I have no problem with ideas being aired on the show, which I disagree with, but the lack of pushback against such wild assertions seemed totally out of character for Unbelievable. Megan got in touch to say, I'd first like to say thanks to Ruth for stepping up and hosting it. It's always lovely to hear her voice. I was, however, disappointed in the podcast. I felt like the arguments were racialized, out of context, and one-sided. And I'm surprised Dr. Bantu didn't push back on Dr. Varma's unorthodox treatment of scripture and culture. Dr. Varma seemed to use the Pauline letters as a stand-in for Roman diffusion, which doesn't make sense to me, as Paul was Jewish. I also found his conflation of African and Jewish culture confusing and fraught with flaws, even though I understand the geological basis for his argument. Most of all, I was disappointed with the tone of the discussion. It felt full of anger and power struggles. Worshipping across five continents with believers of different language, culture, and skin colour has been one of the most beautiful depictions of God's grace, diversity, and creativity I've ever experienced. I wish the focus of the discussion could have included the many, many cross-cultural Christian organisations who are celebrating our shared differences, instead of focusing solely on, globally speaking, the minority of Christians who prefer a blonde Jesus. But thanks again for overall an amazing podcast. Thank you, Megan. So I just thought I'd read out some of those. There are more, I'm afraid, of a negative perspective to that show. And again, just put my hands up and say, I'm sorry, we didn't get this one right. Okay. I mean, both Dr. Varma and Dr. Bantu were interesting and relevant guests for the subject, but it just somehow misfired. And I can understand the frustration that a lot of listeners felt at a number of points, for instance, by Varma around the Bible and slavery and early Christianity not really being challenged on the show. Again, that's our fault. Likely a sort of some miscommunication, really, in the format we were looking for that show. And as many people have pointed out, there wasn't the usual kind of interaction and engagement that there should have been for doing justice to this question. Perhaps it wasn't made clear enough that AJ Varma wasn't there representing an Orthodox Christian viewpoint, if you like, but very much the perspective of what is essentially a different religion, the Holy Coptic Church, which is very critical of mainstream Christianity. Vince himself, very much an Orthodox Christian believer. And if in terms of what he actually said on the show, very much that came through, I thought. But a casual listener might have gone away with the misimpression that because AJ Varma's points weren't really challenged, that Vince somehow agreed with him on all of them. And that, of course, isn't true. But as I say, that's down to us. We dropped the ball on this one. Bit of a misfire. And if and when we do this kind of issue again, we'll do our best to make sure we do it justice next time. So that comes from me. Anyway, we did at least have a few responses that were sort of a little more positive, or at least wanted to chime in on some of the points that were made in the show. Eric said, I've been listening to Unbelievable for a few years. It's really helped to expand my perspective and give me a lot of guidance on my faith journey. This is the first time I've been compelled to write to the show in response to something I heard in the episode, Is Christianity a White Man's Religion? In the show, Dr. Varma mentions that England began to be portrayed larger on maps and implied it was done so to exaggerate its importance. I've heard that argument before and have always wondered why I've never heard a counter using simple geometry. Contrary to what you may have read on the internet, the Earth is a sphere. When you represent the surface of a sphere as a rectangle, there is going to be some distortion. On a globe, the north and south poles are represented as single points, but on a map, they span the entire width of the map. This distortion increasingly inflates the apparent size of any map feature the further it is from the equator. Countries close to the equator, like Liberia, are going to have their proportions closely conserved, while countries distant from the equator, like England, are going to appear relatively wider. I know oppression does exist, and historic oppression is much to blame for many of the inequalities we see today, but it doesn't help anyone, nor does it promote civil discourse, to blame any inequity we see on oppression. Sometimes it's just math, science, or nature. Thanks for all the work you do in fostering open and honest discussion. Thank you, Eric, out in San Diego, California. And also this from Jeffrey, who said, very happy to see Dr. Bantu on the show. Although your presence on the show is always missed when you're away, I can't help but be impressed that you gave today's episode to two black men and a woman. Plus, Ruth is always a delight. Cheers. Both guests agree that Constantine's conversion, such as it was, produced a rupture from authentic Christianity. Constantine could be a very interesting topic for a future episode. Maybe Dr. Bantu or a Mennonite or Seventh-day Adventist could debate an Eastern Orthodox guest. Eastern Orthodox Christians actually venerate Constantine as a saint, so I'm sure that would make for a great episode. Come to think of it, Coptic Orthodox Christians, while not going so far as to venerate Constantine, do honour him with the title of righteous, and he's commemorated more than once on their religious calendar, so maybe a Copt would make a great guest too. Thank you very much for getting in touch, Jeffrey. Let's just go to a couple of more responses, and this time we're going to go a little bit further back to the episode on Ravi Zacharias, the Ravi Zacharias scandal. Still got a lot of feedback coming in on this as people listened to that discussion between Glenn Scrivener and Diane Langberg that Ruth and I hosted. Kevin gets in touch to say, I just wanted to let you know that on the 20th of March, we'll be hosting a free masterclass with Diane Langberg on authority and abuse in the church. And you post me the details, and it's being hosted by the European Leadership Forum. So if you'd like to check that out, if you enjoyed Diane Langberg's contribution a couple of weeks ago, then check out that free masterclass on the 20th of March. Look up the European Leadership Forum for more details. Thanks for sending that in, Kevin. Kira got in touch as well. Kira's a long-time listener of the show. In fact, we met a few years ago when she and a friend came over from the US and sat in on a show that I recorded. And Kira's great. Runs her own podcast, Just Listen to Yourself. And says, I just wanted to let you know, Justin, I was very moved by your Ravi Zacharias mea culpa. That's the video I filmed, sort of giving my personal response to that. And you say it inspired the latest episode of your own podcast. I played your video and broke down your talking points and used them to extend that logic to how we treat each other politically. I know you're busy, but if you have a chance, I hope you'll take a listen. Thank you very much indeed. And I'm glad you enjoyed the show with Glenn as well, Kira. And great addition of the podcast. Thank you very much. If you want to listen to that yourself, it's called Just Listen to Yourself with Kira Davis. Perry gets in touch as well, longtime friend of the show, Perry Marshall, who says your coverage of the Ravi disaster was perfectly executed, especially Diane Langberg's remarks towards the end. Ravi's problems have much in common with the fall of Bill Hybels, who evaded repeated Me Too accusations until the New York Times furnished undeniable evidence. I used to attend Willow Creek, thus I'm closer to that situation than most. There is never just one cockroach, and the cockroaches were called out by some, but those who knew lacked some combination of influence, will, or courage to pull the red lever. Layers of denial irreparably damaged these organisations. Willow's entire board resigned, yet it still didn't undo the damage. I've witnessed this flavour of catastrophic leadership failure in all of the three churches that have been a major part of my life. Something is systemically wrong with the way most Christian organisations are led. I'm searching for better answers, but don't have them. And I don't think the secular world is better in this regard. It's just that the hypocrisy is far more inexcusable from a pastor than it is from a college professor or CEO. Thanks, Perry, for getting in touch on that one. And maybe just finally, Carrion Down says, "Dear Justin, I've just discovered your podcast, hugely enjoying listening to them. Really pleased to hear I have 15 years worth of listening to do. I'm working backwards, so I've just finished listening to the Ravi Zacharias episode. And I have a question for the lady psychologist you had on the show." It was Diane Langberg. You say, "A question I've had for some time, and every time another great falls from grace, it comes back to me again. How does a man of God justify in his own mind what he does? From Ravi, we heard that he told one woman, at least, that he thought this was his reward from God. Someone like Ravi, who had all his theology in order, must have known deep down that what he was doing was wrong. Worse, evil. What do people like this tell themselves? How can they function in prayer? How do they come before God? How? I'd love to hear your psychologist's insight on that. I may be too late with my question." Carrion, you are too late for that show, of course. And I'm not a psychologist, but I would venture to guess that the reality is people somehow manage to rationalize evil. Even people who can often do good things in other parts of their lives, they can lead double lives. And as I said in my own personal response, the heart is deceptive. And some things that I guess can begin small can develop into things that become essentially forms of addictive behavior. And I don't know exactly if that was what characterized Ravi's exploitation and abuse of these women, but certainly I don't think it can be denied that he knew it was wrong. After all, people don't cover up stuff that they don't believe is wrong. But people can somehow compartmentalize, rationalize, and lead double lives. It's been witnessed again and again and again. And it is, in my opinion, part of the fact we are fallen humans. It doesn't excuse it, but it is the reality of the human condition. We are so, so willing to fool ourselves, aren't we? Anyway, thank you for all those helpful responses across those last couple of shows we've recorded. Thank you for being with me on today's show. Hope you can be with us on Saturday, the 15th of May. Unbelievable.live is the place to go to book your place for this year's Unbelievable the Conference. Really looking forward to seeing people there, and lovely to get lots of messages this week from people who have booked in. But for now, I'm going to love you and leave you. Tell you that on the profile later on this evening, you can hear Dan Walker talking to Marcus Jones about his life as a BBC presenter, hugely famous here in the UK, Dan Walker, and the subject of the latest profile interview in Premier Christianity magazine. So listen out for that tonight, or indeed on its own profile podcast. And right now, let me tell you what's coming up next week. Well, actually, we're still working on what we'll have on this show next week. Few options on the boil. But would love to tell you about a new podcast on the horizon soon. In 2 weeks, we release our new C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath. So look out for more details of that. And then soon after that, on Easter weekend, we'll be launching our Big Conversation Season 3. Really excited to say our first episode features YouTube atheist Alex O'Connor, aka Cosmic Skeptic, in conversation with the influential Christian thinker Bishop Robert Barron of Word on Fire, also well known for his very successful YouTube channel. Well, they'll be talking about atheism and Christianity, which makes best sense of who we are. And we've got plenty more exciting conversations from the Big Conversation coming up thereafter. Look out for a teaser coming hopefully in the coming week for the new season. For now, thanks for being with me, and we'll see you next time.